ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, this is David Rutledge. Great to be with you once again here in the Philosopher's Zone. Now, I don't know about you, but over the past maybe decade or so, I've been coming across this term metamodernism more and more frequently. I first encountered it in academic philosophical writing, but more recently, it's started to crop up increasingly often to point to a certain shift in cultural sensibility, movies and TV shows and music and other cultural artifacts being described as metamodern. And the implication here is that familiar terms like modern and postmodern no longer suffice as accurate descriptors of the world we're living in. Metamodernism, as a contemporary cultural framework, was first diagnosed by a couple of cultural theorists from the Netherlands, Timotheus Vermeulen and Robin van den Akker, in a 2010 paper titled Notes on Metamodernism, where they defined the term in terms of a dynamic, an oscillation between modern sincerity and postmodern irony. Since then, metamodernism has been explored by a number of writers and thinkers, one of the more interesting of these being Greg Demba. He's an independent researcher in popular culture and media based in Seattle. He has a number of irons in the fire, including the website What is Metamodern that he co-authors with the scholar of comparative religion, Linda Seriello. And Greg Demba is my guest this week. Okay, so metamodernism is what we're talking about today. But before we get to that, can we spend a little time on modernism and postmodernism, just for the sake of orientation? What do you understand by those terms, modernism and postmodernism, and the relationship between them?
Sure. So just abstractly, these are names for what I guess I would describe as cultural sensibilities, and they're associated with time periods, but the exact definitions of when those time periods begin and end, you know, is up for debate. And these cultural sensibilities sometimes occur outside of those time periods. And it's not a, 100% lock that a particular time period has one of these cultural sensibilities. All that being said, then modernity is the name for the time period that goes all the way back to perhaps the 17th century with the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. And then modernism is a time period that begins around the turn from the 19th into the 20th century. And it's a kind of intensification of the changes that happened with modernity that has much more focus in the arts. And then the time period that postmodernism begins is around the second half of the 20th century. So modernity and modernism are kind of a break with traditional thinking. You could say that the value in traditional thinking is the continuity of knowledge from the past. So in general, people look to what they can learn from their elders, from canonical literature, from religious scripture, from folk tales, from the kinds of things that parents teach their children at very young ages, all of that. And it just kind of accumulates and things are held on to fairly tightly in order to not lose crucial, essential knowledge for the survival of society. But the modern sensibility kind of seeks a disruption from that tradition and wants to take advantage of all of the possibilities of the human intellect and rationality to try to discover actually what is, quote unquote, really true, and to find universal truths and sort of objective truths, and to try to see what's really going on by taking things apart and looking at the pieces and finding like foundational principles that kind of, you know, explain many things at the same time. And a metaphor that I like to use to describe this way of thinking is scraping away the detritus that has accumulated on surfaces and digging down and finding something more enduring underneath. And so that's kind of what's going on with archaeology and anthropology, and the anthropologists of the modernist period, you know, the period that begins around 1900, maybe a few decades before, the anthropologists there were looking to discover deep underlying structures that occur in all societies across the planet if you look past the kind of superficial bells and whistles and details of any given society. And then the modernist architects wanted their buildings to actually show the functional structure, to get to the bones of the buildings and kind of celebrate that kind of stuff, and not utilize things that weren't necessary, not utilize ornamentation that wasn't necessary for the actual structure. And this same kind of thinking occurs in visual art, same thing in literature, and then in music. Okay, so going through this very quickly, that's modernism. Postmodernism, as I said, emerged around the middle of the 20th century. And that kind of came about when people who had been taking modernism seriously sort of took it to its limits and then discovered that the premises of modernism were not necessarily valid, like that modernism itself undoes its own premises. So with this metaphor of digging under surfaces to find sort of enduring truths, which the modernists were pursued, that kind of a thing, the postmodernists discovered that metaphorically, when you dig down and find a layer that you think is the truth, you can actually keep digging. And there's a layer under that. And there's another layer under that and another layer under that. And they found that the sort of modernist tendency to want to take things apart and reduce things to the parts and kind of get like a clean view of things by doing so, that when you take things and look at them in parts, you lose important aspects of reality that have to do with the relationship between parts and the relationship of a whole to the bigger system that that thing is a part of, that kind of thing. And then the awareness that any given viewer or artist or author or thinker or audience exists in a context that may include points of view and perspectives that have not really been given enough attention. So another aspect of the postmodern sensibility is to be careful to look to the margins and look outside of kind of the dominant social narrative. And a lot of postmodern art, and by art, I also mean literature and film and music and all these things, it's often preoccupied. Like any given postmodern artwork will have a theme or a topic like anything else would, but there will also be this underlying additional preoccupation, which is making sure that the audiences of these artworks know that it is an artwork and that the artwork has relations to other artworks and to, you know, all kinds of cultural and social dimensions and things like that. So there's this kind of restless motivation to always keep track and awareness of kind of the bigger context that anything belongs to. And there's a skepticism and a suspicion about sort of simple narratives that claim to be universal or objective. You always have to think of the other possibilities. And there's even the questioning of the self. Are ourselves actually a real thing, or are they fictions that we maintain? And do artworks actually have authors, or is the author of an artwork the whole society, including the viewer and the person who claims to be the author? And all of those kinds of things are kind of part of the postmodern sensibility. I guess I'll stop there.
That situates us really, really nicely. And so now we arrive at metamodernism. And the way you write about it, I mean, you see metamodernism as being a certain kind of corrective. It seeks to correct certain unwanted side effects of modernism and postmodernism. So tell me about that. What are those unwanted side effects, and what is metamodernism?
Yeah. In my view, the main unwanted side effect of postmodernism is a loss of the self. And another kind of thing that happens in postmodernism is irony is a big aesthetic in postmodernism. And there's this kind of embarrassment at being caught taking anything too seriously, including people's feelings and people's interior experience and people's vulnerabilities and frailties. And modernism also potentially undermines these same things in the way that modernism can often wants to reduce complex phenomena to simple underlying explanations. And so, you know, modernism might have a tendency to also reduce the sort of unexplainable but very real inner experience that individuals have. So in my view, the metamodern sensibility is preoccupied with reasserting the interior dimension, reasserting what I call felt experience. But while doing so, you know, it's still existing in a world shaped by postmodernism and by modernism before that. So it can't simply kind of return to an innocent state from before those things. It has to kind of take them into account and show an awareness of the postmodern and modernist insights and do all of that while expressing something authentic and meaningful.
Okay, so a sort of modernist or modern enthusiasm for the new, but also a sense of that sort of endless self-referentiality that postmodernism brings. You see it as a sort of oscillation between those two things. Can you give me some examples of what you see as meta-modern cultural artifacts?
Yeah, and that oscillation that you mentioned is kind of a common, you know, buzzword, if you will, that's often used to explain metamodernism. And so they talk about oscillations between the polarities of the modern and the postmodern. So an oscillation between modernist earnestness and postmodern irony, or modernist universalism and postmodern fragmentation, modernist hope and postmodern cynicism, those kinds of things. And so one of the first instances of a metamodern cultural product, if you will, that I encountered, and this guy, it's the singer-songwriter Jonathan Richman. He's kind of a cult guy, cult-following guy. And he was doing his thing, you know, even in the 90s or even in the 80s, before metamodernism really caught on. But he had been in kind of a early sort of punk rock band, or the Modern Lovers are almost maybe considered the predecessor to punk rock, like coming out of the Velvet Underground style. But then at some point, he shed the sort of harsh kind of punk rocky vibe of his band and started singing songs with titles like I'm a Little Dinosaur or Affection or things like that, where if you didn't know what was going on, you might wonder, like, is this guy making children's music? Or is this guy like an unaware idiot savant who doesn't even really know that he's making children's music, and maybe people are laughing at him, or are they laughing with him? And then as you pay more attention, you realize he's actually evoking very deep, kind of relatable adult feelings through this playfully childlike music in a very sophisticated way. And so then you think, oh, maybe he really knows exactly what he's doing and is succeeding at conveying emotion in a way that, you know, the most seriously earnest musicians never even did as well as him. And then he takes it a little further and you're like, oh no, this must be a joke. This guy's kidding. And if I start tearing up, people are going to think I don't get the joke. Maybe this is all a joke. And you just go back and forth with this while you're experiencing his music until you kind of realize like there's no landing place for this. And you just have to be with all of those dimensions. And I was a guy who kind of came of age, my teens and 20s in the 80s and 90s, and postmodernism, where things just generally are ironic and just are a joke, and that's what is was kind of the prevalent cultural style. And so when some of my friends and I discovered Jonathan Richman, and we had been steeped in the theory of postmodernism in college, we were wondered, what is this? What do you call this guy? It's postmodernism isn't enough to explain what's going on with him. And kind of put that aside. And then around the turn of the 2000s, we're now progressing, you know, many years down the road, this sensibility that I had seen in Jonathan Richman started to seem to pop up, you know, not even just in the kind of underground cult following world of Jonathan Richman, but in movies by auteurs like Wes Anderson and Miranda July, and in fiction by Dave Eggers and Zadie Smith, and in music, it kind of came up in the indie rock genre of music with bands like Sufjan Stevens and Elliot Smith and Death Cab for Cutie and the Ben Folds Five. And in all of these cases, there's like an honoring of the postmodern ironic aesthetic, but a refusal to be caught in it. And so, just like with the way I described Jonathan Richman, each of these artists found their own ways to honor the postmodern, but insist on bringing in something earnest and emotionally meaningful.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, I'm David Rutledge, and joining me here in the Philosopher's Zone this week is the Seattle-based author Greg Demba. We're talking about metamodernism. You cite the TV series Fleabag as a more recent example of this, which that one really struck me because I've watched it maybe three times now. And the way that it uses distancing techniques right throughout, I mean, the way she keeps breaking the fourth wall and speaking to camera, the way that characters are dealt with in these sort of comic grotesques, and yet somehow it is deeply emotionally affecting. There's a real sincerity in the relationship between her and her sister. You know, I didn't... until I saw that cited in your work in the context of metamodernism, I didn't have a name for what that was, but it did strike me when I was watching it. It's a very, very good example, I think.
Yeah. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, she has a very wry affect going kind of almost all the time. And if this were simply a postmodern television show, that would be the main and only thing, is just the wryness, and you would just chuckle at her little asides and her commentaries and things like that. But what actually happens in Fleabag, and why I think it's metamodern, is because alongside all of that wry, knowing joking, like as you said, there's just this deep vulnerability, and anybody watching it is going to, you know, over and over again be like, that's how I feel, or that must be how this person who I care about felt in a similar situation. And the show does not flinch from giving us all of that.
So we have this insistence, if you like, that interiority matters. And yet, I wonder why we need a whole new ism for this. I mean, why is it that metamodernism should be seen as a sort of a decisive break, maybe not a decisive break, but as something different from postmodernism, rather than just a kind of course correction, a new inflection of postmodernism?
That's a fair question. I feel that it's reasonable and helpful to think of metamodernism as its own new thing and not just sort of a little wrinkle in postmodernism, in the same way that postmodernism itself may have originally just been thought of as a course correction or a kind of wrinkle or permutation on modernism. Like postmodernism itself is responding to the place that modernism had brought us. And then it eventually, you know, became consensus to say, well, maybe modernism is mostly over and postmodernism is the thing. And the same with metamodernism, if the first example I gave, Jonathan Richman, had remained just kind of a one-off guy, then we wouldn't need a theory to describe a whole thing going on. We would just kind of say, well, he's postmodern, but he does it in this kind of unique way. But now that there's just so many instances that are describable by this metamodern sensibility, I think, you know, if you try to use the theories of postmodernism to explain this stuff, you're just stretching those theories further than they were meant to go. And we might as well say metamodern, and, you know, modernism was about 50 years, postmodernism about 50 years. Now we're about 20, 25 years into something that we can call metamodernism. I don't know. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, something that also came up in your writing that really interested me was that you write quite correctly, I think, about how modernism has its philosophers. You know, we see sort of the likes of Marx and Freud as sort of arch-modernist. Foucault, Derrida, Deleuze, and the others, these are the sort of postmodernist philosophers. One direction in which you see room for metamodernism to expand is in developing its own, what you call, philosophical anchor points. Tell me more about that. What or who might these anchor points be for metamodernism?
Yeah, and before I go into that, I just want to give a caveat that I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a student of philosophy. And so I'm looking at what I can see of contemporary developments in philosophy as if they are themselves cultural objects, just like a film or a band or something like that. And I'm looking at it as an outsider to the field of philosophy. So I'm looking for philosophical developments that have to do with this kind of renewed insistence on the importance of interiority. And one of the big ones is I think he's Australian, actually, David Chalmers.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So David Chalmers, around the 2000, a few years before 2000, he took the field of philosophy of mind by storm by writing a paper and then a book that was convincing to a lot of people. And he came up with a term, the hard problem of consciousness, or the hard problem of mind. And he pointed out that with the kind of modernist and postmodern approaches to philosophy of mind, people had just kind of given up on accounting for interior experience, and instead were explaining consciousness in terms of the neurological underpinnings. That would be kind of a modernist thing to do, or explaining consciousness as the product of a society and of the many impinging social influences on any given person. And that would be kind of a postmodern thing to do. And he reminded everybody, because it's not like nobody had ever tried to account for interior consciousness, you know, ever in history, but it had become unpopular to speak of the interior. And he made an argument for what we're missing by doing that and why you can't really get away with ignoring interior. And so he kind of set the stage for that. And then now it became possible for philosophers to consider positions like panpsychism, which actually see the possibility of consciousness in matter itself. And I'm not really qualified to go into detail on that, but what struck me is that it's at the same time that all of these filmmakers and rock bands and novelists are reasserting the importance of the interior, so are these people in the philosophy of mind. And then another kind of field in philosophy that intrigued me is object-oriented ontology. And the primary thinker in that field who I've paid the most attention to is Graham Harman. And he sought to develop an ontology that takes things as primary, rather than doing the modernist move of reducing a thing to its component parts and to fundamental physical properties and explanations. And rather than doing the postmodern move of understanding everything as being part of some kind of a bigger system and the sum of its influences, he asserted that there are objects, you know, his term, an object is something that is neither reducible to parts nor can be sort of subsumed and dissolved into contextual explanations.
What does he give as an example of that kind of object?
Well, one like kind of just really concrete and simple example, and I think this comes from Heidegger, but again, I'm not a philosopher, so I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but is the hammer. And the idea is that if you were to break a hammer into parts, into the head and the handle, we'd all agree that that would not be a hammer anymore. The hammer is only a hammer because of its totality and its ability to do the thing that hammers are made for doing. And so that's the way that a hammer reduces what Harman calls undermining. And then it resists overmining, or sort of the dissolving of things into context, in the sense that a hammer is a hammer. Like, a hammer hits nails, and you can't really, in a meaningful way, insist on contextualizing a hammer and saying, like, well, this is what hammers are like in our time, but they had a completely different meaning in the 17th century, or, you know, people of one ethnic group experience hammers this way, but people of another ethnic group experience hammers another way. A hammer is a hammer as a hammer, as an object.
That's a great example, but it makes me wonder, you know, where's the interiority there? If we have a metamodern emphasis on individual interiority, how does that apply to that example?
Well, I'm not saying that I think that hammers, you know, are sitting there daydreaming or whatever. So that's a good question. Yeah, it's a little bit paradoxical because part of the object orientology's move is to say that things don't have to have interiority in order to matter, but what they do have is agency. And Harman and the other triple O people kind of have lots of beautiful sort of examples. So an object could be a hammer, but an object could be the concept of democracy, or an object could be the solar system, or an object could be a particular human, or an object could be a family. And the idea is that each of these objects has its own sort of sovereignty or an independent agency to it. So it's not the kind of interiority that we experience, but it has an equal privilegedness in terms of cause and effect relationships, rather than outside of object-oriented ontology, there are some who kind of privilege the human perspective and kind of think everything has to be understood in terms of language and human intellectual processing. And then there's another one which says everything needs to be understood in terms of physics. And object-orientology is kind of going like, no, each thing is what it is on its own terms. And I feel like that's part of metamodernism, because what we do is we, in our imagination, we project as if the things had interiority. And that kind of anthropomorphizing or projection, I consider to be like kind of one of the methods of metamodernism.
I completely get that. Yeah. As someone who relentlessly anthropomorphizes everything around me, I completely understand how that works. Yeah.
So, yeah, this is kind of getting a little convoluted, and I'm kind of approaching this from around the side of it. But in a lot of the artworks that I would consider metamodern, you will see that kind of anthropomorphizing in Wes Anderson films and in metamodern design. Things will have like objects will have eyes on them, or in the film Everything Everywhere all at once, the googly eyes keep showing up on things and making them feel like they're creatures with interiority, like humans have.
One, I suppose, positive thing about postmodernism is that it has enabled, or at least it's furthered a certain kind of political radicalism that exposes the workings of power within universal grand narratives. And I mean, this has been essential to projects like feminism and anti-colonialism. Is there a danger, do you think, that metamodernism could abandon or soften that kind of critique in favor of emotional comfort, you know, at a time when political engagement has never been more important?
I think that there is that danger. And I think that that's one direction that the metamodern sensibility can go in, and it does, and it off, you know, and it will probably in the future. But another direction that the metamodern sensibility can go is in engaging in that radical political way and taking the crisis of the world and the crisis of individuals very seriously, but doing it in a new way that brings back possibly some of the importance of interiority that maybe was missed in postmodernism. So, you know, somebody might complain about a postmodern movement and say, like, well, this is all really important stuff, but where's the place for the individual in it who still cares about the peculiarities and the, you know, the trials and tribulations of their own little life in their own little world? And I can think of some, like the film, the recent film, One Battle After Another, is about radical revolutionaries taking on the man, so to speak. But it does it in a meta-modern way where the concerns and the foibles and the frailties of the individuals who are engaging in these missions is still centered. And even with the antagonists of the film, there's this sense that, like, everybody you encounter is a person with their own story and their own difficulties. And even the ones who are anathema to you, who are your opponent, they're doing what they're doing for some sort of a reason, for some quirk of who they are, and they have a backstory too. And all of that, to me, is, you know, really brought out in that film. That's an example.
One thing that I often think about is how Jacques Derrida, right, you know, supposedly the arch postmodernist, he was once challenged about his views on meaning and morality. And the question was that familiar question along the lines of, if language is unstable and meaning is constructed and morality is contingent, then presumably anything goes, we can mean anything we like, everything is morally permissible, we can do anything we like. And Derrida replied that, you know, we as a society, we do make our own morality and our meaning, which shifts and changes through history. But it's not as though anyone can just mean or do anything they like. We're still constrained within social conventions, communities of interpretation, this sort of thing. So there are no ultimate grounds for meaning or morality, but we still have to live and act as though there were. That strikes me as a sort of impeccably postmodern position, but also a metamodern position. Would metamodernism add anything to that? I've always found that a very interesting sort of paradox.
You know, I would call that proto-metamodern. I would say that he was being challenged out of the motivation that eventually led more and more people to seek metamodern approaches to things. And so it's kind of, he was confronted with the end of the postmodern logic, like the limits of the postmodern logic. And then he came up with an answer that yields a metamodern viewpoint. And then another one that I'm aware of related to Derrida is, didn't he say something like, there are certain things that are not deconstructible? And an example he gave was justice. And he may have given other examples. And I think that that came, you know, in the later part of his career, right? In the beginning of the 90s, maybe, or the late 80s or something.
Yeah, his work was taking a turn toward the political at that point, yeah.
So, you know, you could say, well, Derrida, the, you know, poster boy or poster child or whatever, the poster man, of postmodernism was saying these things that sound metamodern, but that was like early. It wasn't part of an overall milieu where that kind of thinking was dominant. It was kind of a wrinkle put on postmodernism, or, you know, it was like the beginning. And then just in terms of sort of justifying the periodization of metamodernism versus postmodernism, I feel that, you know, and there's other instances of things that feel like they meet the criteria of metamodernism, but happening earlier. There are many of those, but they were not existing in a sort of networked context where they bounced off of each other and resonated with each other and kind of formed something in the air in general. I don't know. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. One thing, I mean, I'm not sure where I read this. It might have been in your own work. It might have been somebody commenting on your work. But it was this idea that if you boil it down to one key phrase, you could say that where postmodernism was deconstructive, metamodernism is reconstructive. So if we accept that, do you think that reconstruction requires foundations? And if it does, what are those foundations for metamodernism? What are its metaphysical commitments, if any?
I think that I'm going to go out on a limb and say this. I think that the metaphysical foundation or commitment of metamodernism is interiority and felt experience after taking into account the modernist and postmodernist perspectives. You know, somebody might feel that there's no there anymore, but what they can't deny is you cannot deny that I'm here. There may be no there, but I'm here. My feelings might be suspect from any sort of a postmodern context or from any sort of a modernist neurobiological reduction, but my feelings remain my feelings. They're nothing more than that, and they're nothing less. And that's a place that everybody can stand on.
Greg Dember. He's a writer and researcher based in Seattle in the great state of Washington, USA. You'll find plenty of publications and links to Greg's work on the Philosopher's Zone website. And as always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our past episodes again, you can do that via ABC Listen. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by me, David Rutledge, on Bundjalung Country. Great to be with you this week, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.